another landmark technology demonstration that SRI was involved in was really the first ARPANET link to Southern California. SRI was very involved in the beginning of the ARPANET because, as hard as it is to imagine today, a lot of ARPA's other contractors weren't very interested in networking. Did you immediately see the potential of the ARPANET when you heard about it?
Oh, absolutely. See, it was announced to all of the ARPANET or ARPA's principal investigators, who they would periodically get together at some place for meetings. And so the one meeting where the guys who ran the office, just two people, told everybody that now we're going to go in for this networking business. So we're going to network all your computers together. And the reason why is all they talked about was that if you have data on your machine that the other guy could use, he could reach across to use it. Or if he has computer processes on that you don't have, you can send your data over there to process it. That was the total picture that they had. And for me, I'd been thinking for so long about all this augmenting, thinking, oh, yeah, collaboration and such. Some really strange dialogue going on in there.
You immediately saw the potential of the ARPANET, or the Internet, as it has become, as a tool for collaboration, where other people, even computer scientists of the time, couldn't really envision the purpose of it.
Well, they weren't oriented about the same kind of knowledge work, etc. But anyway, so I brought that up to them. I'll say, well, in that meeting, is, hey, you know, this depends upon people knowing who's got what processes and data, right? Oh, yeah. So then the investigators sort of turned to ARPA and says, well, you got to make us a database about that. And the two guys in ARPA with one secretary looked at each other and they had thought of that. And for me, that was just a chance. And so I raised my hand and said, well, this would be the kind of thing that interests me, that we set up a network information center that can be reached through the network that sort of tells what resources are where, et cetera. Oh, whew, that was a relief to everybody. So that's why we were made the number two node to get that started. So I hired one of the young librarian gal from the SRI library, and she was stuck with us for a long time. She's available. She volunteers over at the Computer History Museum. Her name is Elizabeth Feinler, F-E-I-N-L-E-R. She somehow got the nickname Jake when she was a kid, so everybody calls her Jake, because she came and was a principal in getting that nick organized, and then after the rest of us got expelled, she stayed and ran that for some years at SRI.
Now, running the NIC nowadays is a big business. A lot of the technologies and services that you are creating at SRI are done by major corporations now, or products, or web services. Do you think if you were starting out today, you'd want to be an entrepreneur and do a startup, or do you think that the real innovation is still largely in government-funded academic labs?
Well, the big thing is that the key kind of innovation that I'm concerned with needs to be very much open source kind of thing, open evolution, because the kind of impact it's going to have, it hasn't really, really, really blossomed yet. I'm getting more and more people to hear what I'm saying about that looks like we can get that going. You know, for instance, on a national scale of saying we're going to boost the kind of knowledge capability in our whole country, a challenge, and we want to do it in the most effective way, et cetera. So that's the kind of strategic thinking that I've been struggling with for years and years. So it's beginning to be a few places where that's beginning to be heard. The kind of thing that National Science Foundation small grant is beginning to bring out to the young guys and saying, oh, wow. Because, you know, if you're really going after a capability, and I talk all the time about the collective capability, which doesn't mean that every person in a collective group has to have the same level of capability at all, but the group has to exercise it. You know, how the way they approach big group challenges. Anyway, I can detail that more, but...
Well, that sounds like a theory of management and organizational behavior more than a theory of computing. You've always been interested in what some people would call management aspects of groups working together as well as technical aspects.
Well, if you look at what their capability is, and this is what it depends upon, sure, it depends upon management. It depends on all kinds of capabilities besides how well you can operate a word processor. So that's been the primary purpose for me, and I'm saying the computer can be a very strong factor in that. And in order to gain the most in that, we need to get a much richer perspective about what kind of changes. So there'll be sort of concurrently changes in all sorts of things, of practices, habits, vocabularies, roles within an organization, and on, that the current approaches have that focus on the computer as a start, and that's it.
Do you think that part of people's difficulty in understanding what it is that you want to accomplish has to do with the fact that a lot of your goals are related to the social sciences, and many engineering people who are interested in your computer work don't have a real grasp of social sciences?
Right. And cultural. And other things like looking at the basic human capabilities that we exercise when we're learning these things and operating in them. And there's a capability that they call perceptual in yourself. Visual and sonic and touch stimuli come into you, and bingo, they're interpreted. You know, you look at a word on the print, and bingo, you don't trace out the characters and sound them out, and the A-E-I-O-U vowels and so on. That word just, bingo. When you hear it coming over the phone, that's a string of words, and mostly it's meaning. So that machinery was evolved in us way before printing and books came out, the basic capability to do that. And yet, when you talk to people about using the computer, they're so welded to the paradigm of the book and the page that you can't get them past the scrolling in a book-like picture.
Part of what we need is new media, especially designed to be understood by means of computers that no one has created yet.
Well, we were starting that, the kind of jumping and viewing, the mobility and the different optional views of what's there were along that line, and they got rejected by everybody. But like these young guys now that are starting to look at it with a different point of view, and so only hope is the paradigms need to change to say the technology, the book, you have to back away from it and say with a new technology you can portray your concepts and their conceptual structures with totally different flexibilities. And yes, a book gives you a paragraph, that's a nice, interesting thing, but there are alternatives that you can flip into place as you want to.
Perhaps when people who have grown up with web pages as the main communication paradigm rather than books start creating their own works, they'll come up with something new and different that won't rely on pages.
It doesn't take that. It just takes people that are willing to explore. And the guys coming to work in our lab were just coming in, here's how we're doing it. Look. So that worked beautifully for all the people in there. But it was just the external observers. Well, here's one kind of a thing that's coming up to say, that's very hard to learn. And we try to say, once you get involved in it, it's not. You start learning it like a new vocabulary. It's hard to learn. So one of my favorite things was to ask them, where do you park your tricycle when you're not using it? Tricycle? What do you mean? a bicycle's hard to learn, and obviously you won't spend the time to learn that because it's hard to learn. But look, everyone is just assumed, brought up in our culture to assume that they're going to learn to ride a bicycle.